And we are very pleased that Brother Dick and Sister Beth are with us today. This is their first Seattle convention, and we are looking forward to a blessing. Now, Brother Dick has served our class, so we know you're going to receive a big blessing, and we're just happy to have them here with us. Another message, you said the lighting was fine as it is? Okay, Brother Jonathan, the lighting's... No, John, it's fine the way it is. We got some off, so thank you anyway. He has chosen for his title, Remain in Ephesus. Remain in Ephesus.
Thank you, Brother David. And it's good to be here. We bring the love of our home ecclesia, Columbus, Ohio. And this is, even though I've been a Bible student all my life, this is an unusual experience for me because usually when I am in a group of Bible students, I know at least half or more than half of the people here. And I don't think I know as many as half of this audience. So it's a blessing. I hope to get to know you before the convention is over. Our topic, as we as was announced, is Remain in Ephesus. It's taken from 1 Timothy chapter 4, the third and fourth verses, which I will read in the Revised Standard Version. As I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus, that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine, nor to occupy themselves with myths and genealogies which promote speculations, rather than the divine training that is in faith. We have here Paul writing to Timothy, an older man writing to a younger man, writing to a younger man who he loved as a son. Timothy was Paul's longtime friend. They had traveled together for some 17 years. They had been co-workers together in planting ecclesias. They had recently spent time together in jail in Rome. And he writes to him now and says, stay and fight in Ephesus. Stay in Ephesus while I go on to Macedonia. Apparently he had just left Timothy in Crete and sent him there and had begged him to stay in Ephesus when he arrived. Now from Macedonia he writes to Timothy, asking him to be sure that he does do what he said he would do, and that's stay there. He asks him to face the people who had persecuted Paul, particularly, and Timothy, and to fight a good fight, and to war a good warfare. And he tells him in so doing, he will be building character as well as having an impact on the people who hear him and the people who refuse to hear and submit to him. The outline of our remarks today are as follows. We're going to look at Ephesus itself, the city, and the background situation behind this episode. We want to look at the main doctrinal issue that Paul was confronting in the books, both 1 and 2 Timothy, as well as some of the other of his writings, the issue of Gnosticism. We're going to look at the combat strategies that Paul gives to Timothy, and in an essence, I think that we could say, summarize that as emphasizing what's important. And then maybe hopefully, if there's any time left, I hope there will be, I'd like to envision with you some ways in which we might be able to apply these to ourselves, how we could remain in Ephesus. I'm doing all this because I feel like this is our opportunity. I don't know if you can read that little cartoon, but it shows a man who's just entered heaven, and I suppose that's St. Peter is saying, it's an interesting idea, Mr. Worth, but if we let you go back for a do-over, we'd have to let everyone go back for a do-over. And in our case, as Christians, this is our opportunity. The time is now. We need to try with the Lord's grace to get it right and to do everything that the Lord wants us to do and to accomplish his work here in the earth. Ephesus was a leading city for over a millennium at the time of the Bible, the New Testament. Its word, it's difficult actually to tell for sure what it means, but some authorities say it means first or desirable. Strong says it means permitted. It was a symbol in the Bible, as well as a city. It's used as a symbol of the first phase of the church, as you know, in the book of Revelation. It was an amazing city. The little medallion you see up there is a reference to the fact that it was the first city that coined gold, and it had gold flowing in the rivers. It was the city that gave us Aesop, the fabler, the city that gave us Midas and Croesus, famous ancient kings. It was the a city that was conquered by successively the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans. It rebelled against all, and yet all of them built it up. All of the mile markers in Asia started at Ephesus. Ephesus was mile one. That's Augustus Caesar called Ephesus the first city of Asia. And it was the third city, really, of the Roman Empire after Rome and Alexandria. It was a hub of many things, not just commerce. It was also a hub of religion, pagan religion. And Paul actually went first to Ephesus on his first missionary journey towards the end of it. And then on that journey is where he met Timothy near the beginning at Lystra. And they traveled together around Greece. They stopped at Ephesus briefly and then came down to Jerusalem. But it was at that brief stop that the church at Ephesus was planted in 52 A.D. And he left off some friends he had just met just recently, a couple of years before, Aquila and Priscilla, who he met in Corinth, perhaps, I think, converted to Christianity at Corinth. And then they moved with him to Ephesus, and they took up residence at Paul's behest and helped plant the church in Ephesus. Ephesus, at that time, was about what Seattle was in about 1910, right after the gold rush. About a quarter of a million people. Now, on the third journey that Paul took, he and Timothy set out from Antioch, and they went through Galatia and Asia Minor, what we call Turkey, and they came to Ephesus quickly. And great doors of opportunity opened there, which are described in 1 Corinthians 15 and are also recorded in Acts, the 19th chapter. And Paul decided, because of those opportunities, to stay there. And this was the longest stay of his missionary career, almost 3 years. Before the end of that time, things were hopping in Macedonia, and he sent Timothy on ahead to work in Macedonia. But he stayed for the entire three-year time. And then he caught up with Timothy in Macedonia, and they came on around. And I'm not sure what happened to Timothy for a while, but Paul ended up in Jerusalem, prison, Rome, prison, and so forth. There was a theater in Ephesus that seated about 25,000 people. It's still there. And at this theater, there's no record that Paul or Timothy ever spoke in this theater, but there is a record of a great conflict that arose in this theater, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. It's recorded in Acts, the 19th chapter. Our text is situated at the time when Paul and Timothy were released from prison in about 63 A.D. and went to Crete with Titus, where Titus was instructed to remain and strengthen the things that remain in Crete. Timothy was instructed, really begged, the text would indicate, by Paul to go on to Ephesus. And Paul took another ship and went to Macedonia, where just a couple years later, he was apprehended once again by the Roman authorities, taken to Rome, and beheaded. And it was shortly before his beheading in Rome that he wrote the second letter to Timothy and the last book of the last written epistle in the Bible, I should say, not counting the book of Revelation. The last epistle was the epistle to Timothy, 2 Timothy. And that was written from Rome just before Paul was killed. And Timothy, however, left about 64 and went to Ephesus and there remained. Okay. Paul was very concerned about, he said the reason he wanted him to go there, as we read at the beginning, was so that they could instruct or command certain men not to teach different doctrines. And the different doctrines that he's talking about are, as we will see, very serious errors that collectively are called Gnosticism, from the Greek word gnosis, which means to know. It's an idea that goes really all the way back to Eden. Back to the time when Eve was tempted by Satan to assume that God had some hidden knowledge up his sleeve that he wasn't willing to share with Eve. And it was the doubt about God that was sown by Satan that caused Eve to disobey the simple instruction that God had given Adam and Eve about not partaking of the forbidden fruit. Knowledge, specifically the knowledge of good and evil in the Genesis account, was what it was that was the temptation to early man. And it remains a temptation all the way down to the present day. Some sort of secret, mysterious, powerful insight that we could get that would make us special and would give us power. Paul told Timothy neither to give heed to myths and genealogies which produce questions instead of God's design of building up in faith. So here we have two contrasting ways of working and living. One of them is to work in harmony with God's design, which is to live a life that we might use as under the heading of the one word, faith. It's belief, it's obedience, and it's fairly simple factual material that's used to support the concepts. On the other side, we have myths, which to the Gnostic do not mean false ideas, but rather interpretive ideas, taken from ancient stories, taken from the Old Testament even, and then spun off into speculative imaginations and mysterious insights into what supposedly God was doing. These are the two courses that that the people faced, and Paul wants Timothy to confront the Gnostic idea and replace it with the truth, faith. It was important to Paul to do this, just reading between the lines, because Paul needed to stay on the road. He had other things he saw that he needed to do, but he knew that the ecclesia at Ephesus, which was such an important city, needed to have a firm hand. And he needed to have the Christians at Ephesus, which were a minority, obviously, of the population, but were still a significant number of Christians, he needed those brethren to be buttressed against the incredible, we might say, New Age ideas that were surrounding them at Ephesus. And the other thing that we see when we read between the lines is that the false teachers that he's talking about are teachers in the church, meeting with the church, brethren, leaders in the church. They were part of the assembly. When you read between the lines, what Paul is saying is, instruct certain men. It's like, if the shoe fits, wear it. What he's saying is, this letter is going to be read out loud to everybody in the meetings. Those in the audience who are teaching these other doctrines are going to hear this message and are going to know it. Those who hear the word said will be reinforced by Paul to not believe what some of their leaders are saying. And the errors, Paul says, in this letter to be publicly read to the ecclesia Paul considers so serious that they would destroy faith itself. Now, the claims of Gnosticism are many, and they include things like the denial of death. They actually say that the Creator is not God, but was rather a demigod who was a selfish and angry God who made the material world. They say that they teach the idea of dualism, the idea that all good things and bad things come from God. They teach the idea that God is a mystery. They call him the unknown father. They teach the idea that marriage, is because it's a fleshly arrangement, is an unclean thing. And that normal things like food are unclean and should be avoided if you want to be spiritual. And so they had a list of foods that one would avoid. Paul directly challenges, as you go through Timothy, you see direct challenges against these ideas. For example, the marriage and food concept, he directly challenges in 1 Timothy 4. He says that various foods and marriage are created by God to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. And he calls that idea, the false idea, he calls a doctrine of devils. And indeed it was. Another idea that was prominent in Gnostic thinking was the idea that God is a mystery, that you can't know God. Paul directly challenges that by saying, we know who God is. He was the creator, and there's only one. Gnosticism said there were many. And he said, there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself a ransom for all to be revealed. And then that's a little dig at the Gnostics. The revealing is not for just a few, it's for all in due time. Gnostic teaching denies the ransom. That's how serious it was. This is a quote from a current day modern Gnostic website. It says, Gnostics do not look to salvation from sin, original or other, that's still part of the quote, but rather from the ignorance of which sin is a consequence. In other words, knowledge is everything. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is salvation. Paul's answer is very simple and direct. He said, it's a faithful saying. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners. Gnosticism has many faces. For example, it eventually worked its way into the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, in the city of Ephesus, just 200 and some years after the time of Paul, 300 and some years after the time of Paul, in 423, there was a council in Ephesus at which anyone who did not agree that Mary was the mother of God, they coined a word, Theotokos, the mother of God, anybody who did not agree with that was anathema, and kicked out of the church. Gnosticism is current as the most popular book at Amazon.com today, the Da Vinci Code, that is pure unadulterated Gnosticism, resurrected from ancient times and brought back as a thriller. The idea that Mary Magdalene was actually Jesus' wife. And there's a movie that's going to be a blockbuster. And Paul warned, he warned in Timothy's day, he said, these people speak lies in hypocrisy. And he also talks about how there would be money involved. They're doing it for filthy lucre. There's always been money in Gnosticism, and there still is. There's money to be made by the producers of this movie. And the producers of the Matrix movie series. That, too, is unadulterated Gnosticism. And I wish we had time to go into some of the details of that. Now, what are the lessons that we can draw from this? Well, the first thing that struck me when I looked at this was that Timothy obeyed Paul. I think right there is an amazing fact. The fact that a man could say to another younger but not young man and say, I want you to go to the city and live there and do some things. And he did it. I think that shows a respect for eldership and a respect for the way God leads his people. That is, through other people who we know, whose character backs up what the Spirit impresses on them to be done. Like Paul, Timothy faced major conflicts at Ephesus, and it wasn't this was not a Sunday school picnic. He faced every week, and it wasn't just weekly that he met, of course. He met almost daily with different brethren around the city. He faced conflicts within the circle of believers every day. And yet he stayed there till his dying day, fighting this fight. Like Paul, he faced major conflicts also in the public spotlight, because Christianity had a major impact on the affairs of the city, economically and religiously. Another amazing fact is that the ecclesia, as far as we know, did not divide. And Paul's counsel throughout all of this experience, even though there were leaders in the church who were preaching things that denied the ransom, they did not divide. Now, there are two people mentioned by name in Timothy who were disfellowshipped. And Paul uses the phrase, turned over to Satan. That means deprived of Christian fellowship. But it's a serious thing. Depriving a person of Christian fellowship is equivalent to turning them over to Satan. That's what is Paul's message to Timothy there. Another thing that's interesting to me, and was quite surprising to me, was that all of the leading evangelists and pastors of the early church, well, maybe not all, but most, the major names, went to Ephesus, and it was a major part of their life. Paul, we know, spent 3 years plus two other trips there. John spent from after somewhere around 52, when there was a persecution in Jerusalem, John, with the mother of Jesus, Mary, went to Ephesus and stayed there. And when John was taken to Patmos, he was taken from Ephesus, which was near Patmos, and was put in exile in Patmos. And all of his epistles are written from Ephesus. Apollos came to Ephesus and did a major work there, as did, of course, Timothy, Aquila, and Priscilla. And another interesting thing about this whole situation is that you'd say, well, this was a hostile environment. This was full of doctrinal error, full of confusion. And yet it was in this environment that the strongest and young members grew. And many of the leaders of the church who were strong, faithful men going forward grew up right there in the midst of that controversy in Ephesus. Ephesus indeed was the agora, the marketplace of ideas. And that's why Paul wanted Timothy, his right-hand man, there in the thick of the fray. Now, in the book of Acts, we can see some examples of Paul's combat strategy that he exemplified during the 3 years he was there, and that Timothy followed when he went there, we can be sure, in his later years. First of all, there was the issue of style, multiple styles of engagement tailored to the audience. It was not one message for everybody, but focused on what the needs of his audience were. His content was current. Of course, it was easier in his day to be current, after all. I mean, it was only 30 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus. That was a hot issue. But it's important to notice that it was things that were on the minds of the people at the time. His focus in his work, as well as what he told Timothy in both 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, he told Titus this too, the thing to focus on, he said, was the milk of the word, foundational truths, not foolish questions. Don't get involved in debate with all of these foolish questions and so forth that the Gnostics are going to keep dredging up. They will wear you out with their foolish questions. You've got to keep focusing on what builds faith, what builds character. The attitude you see in Paul and the counsel that he gives to Timothy in 1st and 2nd Timothy is warmth. Personal care for the people that they are addressing, even if they are opposing them. Enthusiasm, excitement, demonstrated by leaving everything else to focus on this in their life. Their lifestyle, their occupation. The important thing was enthusiasm. The sincerity with which they spoke. That was what won converts. And, very important, mastery of the material. Paul and Timothy, by admonition, were engaged in knowing the facts and having them right at their fingertips and focusing on facts, things that Gnostics don't like to deal with. They like to deal with feelings. They like to deal with opinions. They like to deal with wonderings. The Christian focus was facts, historic accuracy. Getting right down to the nitty-gritty and checking and cross-checking and multiple witnesses. And finally, all of this is tough to do. You constantly keep coming back up. What this is going to give you the strength to do these things? It's going to come from two things. It's going to come from God's Spirit and God's Word, and it's going to come from the character that God builds in you through the hardship that you go through. That's where the strength to do this comes from. Not from gutting it out internally through self-control and determination. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15:22 that he fought with wild beasts at Ephesus. And It's very, very unlikely that he actually got engaged in a gladiatorial combat there. If he had, it would have been in this theater. But that actually, the gladiatorial part of the theater wasn't built until after Paul's death by a later emperor. Paul dealt with in terms of his gladiatorial combat was a controversy over paganism itself. And the interesting thing is that even though it says that Paul fought with wild beasts, in the account of what happened in Acts 19, no, Paul didn't even enter into the theater. That's what's amazing to me in learning about it. Paul, first of all, when he dealt with the pagans, it describes what he did. He went to Ephesus and he spent 3 months in the synagogues, meeting once a week, speaking as he had opportunity to the Jews about Jesus the Messiah. After 3 months, they kicked him out. They'd heard enough. And some followed him, and some stayed. Okay. Then he started meeting at the school of Tyrannus. And that was a place where anybody could come, not just Jews. It wasn't like a synagogue. It didn't meet once a week. It met every day. And the favorite thing, it says in the book of Acts, to do was for Greek men to gather and argue about some new idea. That actually mentions that in context of Athens. But Ephesus was no different. And what it says, when Paul describes what he did to the Ephesian elders, when he recounts his ministry to them while he was in Ephesus, he said he did two things. He said he did dialogue memnos, which basically means dialogue. It's a method of disputing that involves questioning. And it was very familiar to the Greek rhetoricians, such as Aristotle and so forth. It was the idea of you present questions and you make your students give you answers. Then you turn it around, you let your students give you questions, and you turn around and give them your answers. It's a two-way conversation. And that's what Paul did, and it was called disputing in the King James. That's what Paul did in Ephesus. But he also said he did something else. He said, I persuade men. It wasn't just an intellectual exercise that he was engaged in. He also focused on the emotional impact of what he had to say to his audience. He cared very deeply about them as individuals, and he wanted them, if it was God's will for them, to respond and have their lives changed and to be ushered into the bride of Christ. That was his goal and his ministry at that time. And so he persuaded by appealing to their higher nature, to their emotions, and he also appealed to their frontal lobes, their brains, through facts and logic, then dialogue and questioning and answering, knowing the facts. Those are the two things that he used. Now, it's interesting that Paul showed great knowledge of their views, their ideas. He didn't just walk in and spout off Christianity without having a very intimate knowledge of what they thought and what their philosophers said. He read their philosophers. He knew what they said. And he used that as he talked to them. And he also refrained from doing the things that are kind of around us if we look at, say, for example, folks who, out of all good conscience, work to try to stop abortion or perhaps homosexuality, where they will go to a rally or go to an abortion clinic and will try to interfere with the operation of what they do. Paul did not do that. And we know that because on the day that he fought with wild beasts, when there was a huge outcry and the theater was filled with a mob of people who were upset with Paul and what Paul was teaching about paganism and the fact that idols are nothing and that all these silver things that these silversmiths were making were not of anything at all except silver and had no spiritual value or impact. When those people were arguing and hashing that out, The only thing that stopped them was the scribe, the recorder of the city, a very influential man who stood up. He's not named, but he stood up in front of the crowd and he quieted them down, and he tells them that Paul was not a person who plundered or blasphemed. That means speak harshly against their god, Diana. That Paul had never said any nasty things against Diana. He apparently did not use sarcasm, did not use anything that would be that would be undignified. He was very dignified, very factual, but in the privacy of individual dialogue, he would talk about idolatry and that it was, you know, not right. And he gave them reasons why. And that was spreading so fast that it was upsetting the apple cart for the people who made their money off of it. So the point is, a pagan man who himself believed in Diana and who reassured the crowd and quieted the crowd, it's recorded in Acts 19, by telling them that everybody knows that Diana, that Ephesus is the temple keeper for Diana. We are the ones who Diana has entrusted to keep their temple, her temple. Everybody knows that Diana is our god. Paul hasn't spoken against that. And that's how he quieted the crowd down. And he said, Paul did not blaspheme Diana. Paul is a nice guy. Relax. And they all went home. So Paul, on the day that he fought with wild beasts, was ready to go in there and probably would have been killed if he had appeared in front of that mob. But God first used the disciples to stop him from entering the mob scene. And they tried to persuade him, and they apparently wasn't working, because there were two disciples of Paul's that were already nabbed and were in the mob scene. And Paul wanted to go in there. And then the leaders, the influential, the moneyed people, secular pagan people, who knew Paul and respected Paul, came to him and said, please, do not go into that mob. And it was the leaders, it says, the Asiarchs, the leaders of Asia. It's a 10-person committee. Those leaders are the ones who prevailed upon Paul not to go into that mob scene and, you know, ultimately to be killed. That's how God dealt with it. You can see from that little instance that this whole battle was God's fight, not Paul's fight, and God decided when each of his people would be what role they would play and when they would play it. Okay. Paul in Acts 20 tells the Ephesian elders how he dealt with the church. Here it's a little more relevant to what we experience in our day-to-day Christian life. He tells them, first of all, that I showed you. In other words, I set you an example. How did he set him an example? Well, he was a tent maker. He worked hard. He was the shining example of integrity, of hard work, and of focusing on the real bedrock issues of faith and righteousness. He also says that I taught you publicly, preaching and teaching. So there was a public ministry in the ecclesia, large meetings. And he also says, I taught you from house to house. He went to their homes. He had private counseling and discipleship meetings with them. And he calls collectively all three of those things, he calls them his testimony. And the Greek word is martyrion, which means martyrdom. I mean, it really means a pouring out of one's life to the end. And I want to talk for a moment about the fact that he focused on milk. He says in that passage in Acts 20, the things I talked about were two, repentance toward God and faith in Jesus. I'm going to skip this relating to how he dealt with the Jews. And I wanted to just jump to something else about this whole thing with Paul advising or asking Timothy to go to Ephesus. He asks Timothy really to go immerse himself in conflict for the rest of his days. And I wanted to say a couple things about conflict. First of all, it's unavoidable. Does anybody have any doubt about that? The second one is that it's good for you. If you learn God's way of dealing with it. Supposedly, division is an alternative to incessant conflict, but really it's not. All it does is make the church weaker. Now let's look at two scriptures on oil that I think are interesting. One of them says in Psalm 141, "Let the righteous rebuke me." Let the righteous rebuke me. That's conflict. Let the justified person, let God through that justified person rebuke me. It's like an excellent oil, and it won't break my head. I'll live. I'll live being around people who are saying some negative things to me about something that I believe or that I'm doing. Now put it with Psalm 133. How good and how pleasant when brothers dwell together. It says in King James, in unity. But the idea is not that brothers dwell together and they all agree on everything. That's not what it really says. In Greek, or in Hebrew, it says, when brothers dwell yachad together. When brothers dwell together. That's a beautiful thing. It's like anointing oil placed on Aaron's head. That's what dwelling together with brothers is. When we are engaged with our brethren, even those with whom we have doctrinal or other conflicts, we are allowing each other to rebuke each other so that that oil of God's Spirit can flow over us and can change us and prepare us for what God has in mind. Conflict is unavoidable, yes indeed, because God made it that way. I'm going to skip that. The milk. We've talked about the milk. I'm going to skip that too. You know what the milk is. I want to say this though. Milk is personal and practical. That's one reason why it's so important to stress it. With God's help, victory is assured. That's when we dwell on the milk, that's what we keep hearing. When we dwell on the milk, we learn that we can do righteous deeds every day. When we dwell on the milk, we learn that Satan has no power over us because we're focusing, as a child does, on the simple facts that are the powerful facts. And in Peter, we're told that milk is what makes us grow. Galatians seems to be alluding to milk when it talks about the way we are perfected. It's not through our works and our labor. It's through what God does for us. I'm going to skip that. Okay. I'm going to sum up here. To me, to remain in Ephesus means that we will accept, forgive, exhort, teach, serve, encourage, and all of those things together add up to love one another. To remain in Ephesus means that we will avoid strife about words. And we will fight the spirit of division. It does not mean that we will avoid discussing important doctrinal issues and try to understand the Bible. One thing I wanted to say today is that when Paul talks in 1 Timothy 1:4, the theme text here, about genealogies and giving heed to endless genealogies and so forth, he was not talking about the facts that are recorded in the Bible, historic facts. He was not talking about that. He was talking about the spin that Gnostics took from the Bible and from legends to make their theories, speculative ideas that could not be substantiated. So we can and should pay careful attention to chronology and to prophecy, to try to understand with certainty, as clearly as we're capable of understanding, what God's plan and program is for us now. But we need to still, in the midst of that, not force anybody to either change their view, accept a new view, or hang on to the view they already had. We need to avoid the spirit of division as we discuss it and tolerate differences of view within the group. Another point I think that remaining in Ephesus means is that we will have in addition to and much larger than our own discussions. We will have an outward focus. We will use what we learn to try to master the material, master our knowledge of the Bible, and use it in discussion with other Christians. Use it in discussion with Jews. Use it in discussion with pagans. Paganism is coming back. And we don't have the Temple of Tyrannus or the School of Tyrannus, but we have the internet. And we can discuss this with anybody, anywhere, anytime, if we have the facts at our disposal and make it our business to understand and know and speak God's word clearly. If we remain in Ephesus, we will be active, we will be totally committed, we will be dignified and knowledgeable and engaged. We will find friends. We will find amazing opportunities to speak the Lord's word. Amazing opportunities. We will create a stir, and we will be very controversial. We will have heartaches. We may die when our hour arrives. But we will be fighting the good fight, and we will be victorious. May the Lord add his blessing.